Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We are glad to have John Edwards back in our studio to begin the program today. The former presidential hopeful and 2004 vice presidential Democratic nominee, whose name is still being mentioned in this year's Veep Stakes by many. He is in New York to visit a food pantry in Manhattan as part of his new campaign called Half in 10 to cut poverty in half in the United States in 10 years. John Edwards, always good to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be back with you.
So at noon today, you're going to the Yorkville Common Pantry in East Harlem. That's East 109th Street near Fifth Avenue. What's happening there?
Basically, the entire effort we're making this week, including the stop in New York, is to bring attention to this Half in 10 campaign. The name comes from trying to reduce poverty by half in America over the next 10 years. As a campaign that I'm chairing, it's supported by a large group of organizations, grassroots organizations, philanthropic organizations, charitable religious organizations, and we're very proud of the work we're doing, and we're just trying to highlight this issue. There's some very substantive components, ideas, like the child care tax credit, expansion of the earned income tax credit, raising the minimum wage, a set of ideas about how we have poverty.
Any reason for this location in New York? Out of all the food pantries and soup kitchens, does it represent something?
Yeah, it's a place where they're doing great work. It's been very effective over an extended period of time. We thought it was an example of the good things that can be done.
You want to cut poverty in half in 10 years. How much poverty is there in America today?
Well, it depends on how you define poverty. Poverty is still very serious in a country of our wealth. We have, according to the federal government's definition, about 37 million people who fall below the poverty line. People who saw what happened in New Orleans when the hurricane hit there, particularly in the Ninth Ward, saw sort of the personification of poverty in America. And by the way, it's not – we think about this as just poor families – the 37 million who fall below the federal poverty line. But the truth of the matter is the gap between the wealthy and the rest of America has continued to grow and particularly grown over the last 8 years.
What is the face of poverty in America? You mentioned New Orleans, but break it down. How much urban, how much rural, how much black or white or Latino, how much female or young, working or unemployed? Your policy initiative seem aimed at working people. Do you have the basics?
Those are very good questions. First of all, there are millions of people who work full-time and still live below the federal poverty line. A lot of the things that we have proposed, raising the federal minimum wage, raising state minimum wages, expansion of the refundable earned income tax credit, strengthening the right of unions to organize, all work-centric ideas. Those ideas are primarily aimed at people who are, in fact, working. And there are millions of people who fall in that category. The face of poverty in America is to a disproportionate face of color. African-American families have about 10% of the net worth of white families. Latino families are in roughly the same category, slightly higher. So the bottom line is, if you're black or Latino in America, there's a much higher likelihood that your family lives in poverty. And in addition to your income level, there's a much higher likelihood that you have very little in the way of assets to fall back on.
And listeners, we can take some phone calls and, of course, comments on our webpage for John Edwards this morning, 646-778-3729, our temporary phone number, 646-SPUDRAY, if that's the easier way for you to remember it, 646-SPUDRAY or 778-3729, 646-778-3729, or post a comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. How much of the American poor today is people who've used up their five-year lifetime welfare limit under the Clinton-Gingrich reform of 96? Any idea?
I don't know the numbers. What I know is that when we enacted welfare reform in the 90s, there were some very good components of it. I mean, the notion of ending the cycle of poverty, putting people back to work, made a great deal of sense. But there were serious flaws in it also. And you can see the impact of those flaws today. Number one, the greatest impact among poor families was among women. It had very little, welfare reform had very little impact on young men, particularly young African-American men. The second problem was while it got people to work, it got them to work in low-income, low-paying, entry-level jobs, and their ability to advance has been extraordinarily limited. So while, yes, it got people to work, that was a good thing, giving them the skills, the education, the job training, et cetera, that are necessary for them to be able to advance has been very slow. And then the last piece is the other components that were so crucial to making this work, as often happens with the government, have not done their job. Child care, for example. A lot of single working moms do not have access to quality child care or affordable child care. Transportation to high quality jobs. I mentioned job training and education just a minute ago. The problem is the idea, everybody embraces the idea of people going to work who are capable of working. I mean, I believe deeply that every American who's capable of working should be working. But you say to a single mom who has four children, we want you to go to work. You have to go to work. Well, what's she supposed to do with her kids? How's she going to get to work? I mean, there's some very practical problems people are confronted with.
And any reform to the 96 law always bogs down in Congress over exactly those issues. How much child care assistance to give?
Absolutely.
How much college should be counted as work fare?
Yep.
That kind of thing.
You're paying attention. That's exactly right.
Conservatives emphasize family breakdown and say a large percentage of poverty is single parents and their children. You're talking about earned income tax credit, living wage, unionization, but do you have any specific policy proposals related to out-of-wedlock birth prevention or marriage or fathering promotion? Should they be centerpieces of such a campaign?
They are important components of a campaign to end poverty. And I mean, for multiple reasons. I mean, if children don't have if children don't have a father, the likelihood they're going to spend their life in poverty is much higher. When 14 and 15-year-old girls are having their second and third child, the likelihood of that their children and their and themselves will be, live in poverty, that they will live in poverty for the rest of their lives, goes up astronomically. The truth, though, from at least from what I've seen, and I've been to over 100 places, including a bunch of places right here in New York, where people are dealing with the issue of fatherhood, dealing with teenage pregnancy, all these things that you just mentioned. The most effective programs that I've seen were not government programs. They were faith-based groups. They were local. For example, there was an extraordinary program that was developed in Connecticut, in a community in Connecticut, where basically what they did is they took young at-risk girls, provided them with mentors, created some self-respect and self-esteem, and dramatically reduced the teen pregnancy rate, which had been skyrocketing in the community. So I think there are places that the government can help with funding, et cetera, for those things, but a lot of that has to be done at the local level.
But if you're talking about cutting poverty in half,
yep,
is it enough to talk about earned income tax credit, living wage, unionization, without also bringing up as a centerpiece the family breakdown?
Here's the truth. The truth is that if you're me and this issue of ending poverty and ending economic inequality in America is central to your life, and it is central to my life, it is the passion of my life, I believe we ought to do it all. I don't think you can limit it to A, B, and C. These things that we've identified in this Half in 10 campaign are proven, have been proven effective in the past. You can correlate almost mathematically. If we raise the child care credit, the minimum wage, strengthen unionization in the workplace, if we do all these things, we can calculate the impact it's going to have on poverty in America, and poverty will be reduced in half. It's then what you're left with are the more difficult problems with poverty, including some of the things that you've identified.
John Edwards, my guest on WNYC. His initiative called Half in 10 is designed exactly for that, to cut the poverty rate in half in 10 years in the United States. He's visiting a food pantry in East Harlem at noon today as part of that campaign. We'll get to some phone calls for him in just a minute at 646-778-3729, 646-778-3729, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Do you fight urban poverty different from rural poverty? Differently?
Yeah. Yes, it is. There is a difference. For example, it's my belief that our national housing policy has been a complete and utter failure. What we have done over a period of decades now is concentrate poor people together. And we've done it through a variety of mechanisms instead of creating the opportunity and the choice that families can, in fact, choose to live in a different neighborhood, to live in a different school district, to move out of areas of high crime where they don't want their families raised and their children living. And I think there are a variety of mechanisms that can be used to change that. Well, my view is we ought to expand Section 8 housing vouchers, but use them in a different way than we've used them in the past. But, yeah, that's urban poverty. There's some of the same components exist. Access to a quality education, access to decent health care, jobs. Job creation is different in the inner city than it is in rural areas. I mean, the causes are very similar, but the environment is very different.
Put on your headphones. We'll talk to some of our listeners, starting with Marie in Brooklyn. Marie, you're on WNYC with John Edwards. Hello.
Hi there. I just want to say to John Edwards, first of all, I think he's doing an amazing job, and I really respect what he's doing, and thank you for doing this. It's so important. I think you may have just been talking about this. My question was, how much does funding for education factor into this? You know, obviously, I'm in Brooklyn. My kids go to a public school. There's a lot of money in the school, and I see that they have a lot of things that kids in other districts don't have, and I feel like it really starts at that level. So how does that factor into the big picture of what you're doing?
Oh, it's a huge factor. Now, my own personal belief is that we actually effectively have two public school systems in America. We have one for wealthy suburban areas and one for inner city schools and poor rural schools. And the funding base for, particularly when property taxes and mechanisms like property taxes are being used, is very different in those two places. And it's the responsibility of America through our government to even that out so that it's all well and good to hear politicians use the rhetoric of it shouldn't matter where you live, every child's entitled to a quality education. It's meaningless if we're not willing to put the money in place with the proper mechanisms for accountability. So Title I theoretically exists for that purpose, to level out the playing field and to level out the funding, but it has not done that and has not been effective.
We have a, 30% dropout rate in the United States? Higher than that in New York City.
Oh, there are lots of places in America where the dropout rate in high schools are 50% or higher.
That's the face of poverty in America.
Oh, yes, it is. And it's directly connected to poverty.
Dennis in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with John Edwards. Hello. Dennis, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Brian. I'm a big fan. I supported you during your run. My question is, I'd like to know whether you think that the intersection of poverty and race, as it relates to the faltering economy and perhaps resentment being exacerbated pitting poor whites against poor blacks, and do we need to have a nuanced national discussion on the state of race in America?
Yeah, the answer to that is yes. I mean, if you watch those pictures coming out of New Orleans, it was absolutely obvious that the people who were had suffered the greatest impact of the hurricane and the racial division that existed in New Orleans were African Americans. I talked earlier about the racial divide that exists with the poor in this country. Some of it's just common sense. I mean, we live in a country where slavery existed for many decades, followed by segregation, followed by discrimination, both overt and subtle, and much of that discrimination still exists today, at least below the surface. And the bottom line is that has a direct economic legacy. And you can see that in these figures that we've talked about during our discussion of poverty today. I happen to think it's a very healthy thing that in my country we now have an African American who could be the next president of the United States, who I desperately hope will be the next president of the United States, because I think that foments this discussion. I think it creates a natural environment to talk about race in America, racial attitudes in America. You know, there are a lot of people who would rather turn their head and not think about this and not have to have an open public discussion about it. But I think we particularly in this presidential election, it provides an extraordinary opportunity for us to do just that.
Is Barack Obama aware of your Half in 10 campaign?
Oh, he's fully aware of it. I've had multiple conversations with Barack about this issue. Talked to him about when I got out of the race, I got a commitment from both he and Senator Clinton, they were both running at the time, that they would make poverty central to their campaign, spend several days on it during the general election campaign, and make it central to their presidency. That's just in general. I also had some very specific agreements with him about what they would do if they were elected president. So, yes, he's aware of it. By the way, he doesn't need me to tell him about poverty. This is a guy who's worked on this issue his whole life.
Has global poverty gotten worse just since you ended your presidential campaign in January due to the global food and energy crises?
Yes, it has gotten worse.
Here's something from the London Daily Mail yesterday. It says, on Sunday, Prime Minister Gordon Brown called for prudence and thrift in our kitchens after a government report concluded that 4 million tons of food was being wasted by householders. But yesterday, the Prime Minister and other world leaders sat down to an 18-course gastronomic extravaganza at the G8 summit in Japan, focusing on the food crisis. Is that kind of grotesque?
Yeah, and while people are starving. There's so many basic things that we could do to have an America could do to have an impact on this issue of global poverty. Half the planet, most of your listeners know this already, but half the planet lives on $2 or less a day, 3 billion people. There are about a billion people who live on a dollar or less a day. The spread of disease, including HIV/AIDS, continues to be rampant. Population growth, I mean, we've gone from 2.5 billion people in 1950 to about 6.6 billion mm-hmm. today.
So why even focus your campaign on poverty in America as the central focus? There is poverty in America, mm-hmm. but we at least have free meals in schools and emergency room health care and things like that. I've seen poverty in Africa and Latin America where tens of thousands of children die every day around the world from hunger-related causes.
Places like Haiti, yes.
You know about that. Yes. And that isn't happening in this country. Is it the wrong priority?
No, I think it's first of all, you have to be able to walk and chew chewing gum at the same time. You're not required to choose one and ignore the other. I think America, as the most powerful, richest nation on the planet, has a responsibility both to help its own people and to meet its moral responsibility, which Gordon Brown and others have talked about, to deal with this issue of global poverty. What I was about to say a few minutes ago, and I'll just spend 30 seconds on this, if you look at what's happened, I mean, we are faced with extraordinary human-produced conditions on this earth. So I've mentioned 6.6 billion people and the extraordinary population growth, but the population is growing primarily in places least able to support it. And what that means is you create Take a poor place and you make it poorer. You make resources less available. You create economic strife. You create political strife. The point of all this I'm trying to make is whether it's climate change, population growth, global poverty, extreme poverty, economic inequality, we have to, as a nation, recognize that our fate and our children's fate is inextricably connected to the fate of the rest of the planet. This is not 100 years ago. The world has changed. And for America to be safe and secure, it matters to us what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa. It matters what's happening in Haiti. It matters what's happening in rural India. And it's so important for us to have a president who talks constantly to the American people, not just about local issues, but about that big visionary question.
From our comments page, a listener says she's in Switzerland, asks, I know Mr. Edwards is there to talk about poverty, but could you ask him about Obama's recent move to the center, FISA, death penalty, Iraq, and what he thinks about it?
Well, really, the only thing I can comment about is I saw him on television yesterday saying I want everyone to understand that I am a progressive. I have progressive values. I have a progressive set of policy ideas and a progressive belief system, and that I have not changed. And this this is the press, and this is some people who disagree with me politically.
Well, let me focus in on a couple of those and see if you still hold to that. Because the big one that we'll be actually dealing with directly in our next segment, he vowed to filibuster any FISA surveillance bill that included immunity for the telephone companies who may have broken the law in turning over phone records to the Bush administration without a warrant. Now, instead of filibustering it, he'll be voting for it today on the Senate floor. What do you think about that?
I would not vote for it. I think there will actually be a vote on the immunity question specifically. I do not believe the telecoms should get immunity for illegal acts, and so I would not vote for it. But that's a judgment call. I mean, all of these things are balancing, trying to balance national security against individual rights and individual liberty. And on that particular question, I think I would not give them immunity.
And on NAFTA, Obama told Fortune magazine just recently for the new issue that his previous statements calling NAFTA devastating and a big mistake had been overheated and amplified. Do you even understand anymore what Obama's position on NAFTA is today?
Yeah, I know exactly what his position on NAFTA is. His position is, because I stood beside him I don't even know how many times in forums and debates and talking about NAFTA and talking about trade, his position is that all of our trade agreements, including NAFTA, should have meaningful environmental and labor protections that are enforceable and that are, in fact, enforced. NAFTA doesn't have that, and he believes it needs to be renegotiated for that purpose.
But when he called it devastating and then called it a big mistake, and now he says statements like that were overheated as John Edwards' cell phone goes off.
Sorry.
I hope it's not Judith Nathan, that's all.
I'm certain it's not. It's my wife, as a matter of fact. What was the question?
The difference between you and Rudy is you didn't take the call.
correct.
His rhetoric on NAFTA and then saying that that was overheated. Do you understand why that's leaving people confused?
Yeah, because I think it is true that what happens is when you say what I just said or what Barack said during the course of the campaign, I think Hillary said the same thing. What happens is that there are some people who say, well, that's just protectionism. This is all protectionist rhetoric. And they label what you're doing. And I think what Obama's saying is people who have labeled him as protectionist, that he is not, in fact, protectionist. And I know he's not. He believes in trade. But he believes trade needs to be done the right way with the kind of mechanism that I just talked about.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with John Edwards. Hi, David.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Brian. I wanted to say that John was the candidate of choice for both my wife and myself, and I still voted for him even though he had dropped out of the primary by that point. But I wanted to say that I know he's gotten a lot of attention for vice president, and I'm actually rooting for him for attorney general.
Interested?
What I've said repeatedly is I'm interested in getting Barack Obama elected president, and anything I was asked to do, I would take seriously, which I think is the right thing to do if you actually want to serve.
The fact that you disagreed with him here on FISA, should I take that as kind of a hint that you're not really in line for this because you'd have to be lined up on that issue?
I don't think I have to be lined up on anything. I say exactly what I believe.
That was Elizabeth on the phone. How is she?
She's doing great. She's actually, I told you earlier, she's going to be on Talk of the Nation this afternoon talking about health care. Her own health is good, and her spirits are good, so she's doing very well.
I saw her speak via Skype at the Personal Democracy Forum here in New York last month on web organizing. Can web organizing and social networks be used in the fight against hunger?
Oh, of course it can. We are using it because what happens is that there are these mechanisms which are available today to communicate with people, to get people involved, to get people active on this issue. Oh, absolutely. It's an enormous tool available to us.
Can our listeners help with your anti-poverty initiative? Because I know people feel very strongly about this issue, and they hear what you're doing, and they think, what can I do?
Well, if they go to halfin10.org, they can see specifically what they can do. There are some volunteer efforts they can make. They can make small contributions to what we're doing. They can help us educate the American people and put pressure on politicians to do the right thing about this.
One other thing on the living wage. In a globalized economy, shouldn't the real living wage battlegrounds be Mexico and China, or the U.S. will have a living wage but no jobs?
That's a good question. I think that one of the things we have to recognize is because of what I've talked about earlier, because of our link to every other person on the planet, we have to recognize you can't just operate in isolation in America, that what we do here has to be connected with American policy and the rest of the world on every conceivable front. When I talk about having a visionary president and visionary political leadership, that's what I mean. It does no good for America to have, as we should have, serious, aggressive efforts to deal with climate change if we're not part of an international network that's addressing the same issue aggressively.
So John Edwards at noon today will be at the Yorkville Common Pantry in East Harlem. That's East 109th near Fifth Avenue, as part of this Half in 10 campaign to try to cut poverty in half in the United States in 10 years. Is that a public event? Can people come to that?
We would love to have anybody come who wants to come.
109th near Fifth Avenue. John Edwards, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we will have that FISA debate with both sides coming up in just a minute. Stay with us.